Okay, good morning everybody and welcome to the public session of our second day of the IFRS Advisory Council meeting. So we're going to start off this morning by what we actually usually have on the first day, which is the update from the effectively on ISB activities, and we're going to start off with the chairman update. But although we had the chairman with us yesterday, the chairman unfortunately could not be with us today, so Ian is going to, as deputy chair, is going to give us the update, talk to the update report. So Ian, all over to you, hand over to you.
Thanks, Joe. Vice chair it is. Not deputy chair.
And apologies.
Apologies from Hans. I think he's at this moment winging his way to the United States. He wasn't able to be here this morning. We've got paper number 7, which sets out what's going on. A lot of the topics I won't go into in detail because we've dealt with them or will deal with them in other sessions, so rather than repeating it. And then when I've finished going through this briefly and taking any questions, then Hugh will fill it out with some more technical input. So beginning in the first page of the paper, leases, we're working intensively, it says, on leases and insurance contracts, and I can assure you that's the case. We've finalised the deliberations on leasing, and so we're into the drafting and balloting process. We've still got a lot of work to do. We're doing it jointly with FASB, although we don't have a perfectly converged standard. The majority of the bits that are converged, we'll be trying to draft together and hopefully getting the same words. Let's see what happens. We'll decide on the effective date once we've got the drafts finished, and we hope to issue the standard in the last quarter of this year. So that's that one. It'll be accompanied by an effects analysis, and in this case, quite an in-depth and lengthy effects analysis, because there's been quite a lot of controversy as we've been going through the project on what effect it might have on businesses and on economies and various other things. Dire predictions of hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost and the like. So we'll deal as best we can. We're not expert economists, but we'll deal as best we can with those issues in the effects analysis. With insurance contracts, 18 years old and still blooming, that project, we're still deliberating. We've finished the vast majority of deliberations. We'll go through this later this morning, I understand. So on insurance, is it? No, not today. Okay, so I'll go through it now. We've finished most of our deliberations except for contracts with participating features. They really are complex, these issues, and it seems like we will be taking the rest of the year on these deliberations through to December. Then the drafting, if we finish the deliberations by the end of this year, and I'm sure we will, the drafting won't be simple or straightforward after that, so it's likely to take a good deal of 2016, I think, to get it finalised. So that's a bit longer than we'd hoped. Let's hope we stick to our guns this year and get the deliberations over. They're not easy deliberations. And then to add to our complications, EFRAG have done a preliminary or a draft endorsement advice, which is out for consultation until the 30th of June, on adoption of IFRS 9 with a request that we defer the effective date for IFRS 9 for insurance businesses, either we do or they do. And so this is a debate that we're currently having. I attended an EFRAG meeting last week, I think it was, yes, where the insurance industry, the European insurance industry, presented their case. We've said in paragraph 8 here that it's some European stakeholders. Those European stakeholders mentioned also Canada and Japan in that presentation as having similar issues. I think we've had a communication this morning which says that the issue may be even wider than Europe, Japan, and Canada, so that other countries are involved as well. I haven't actually seen that email, but that's my understanding of the gist of it. So we have to think how we address this problem. The suggestion, I think, from EFRAG at this stage, and they, by the way, haven't finalised their endorsement advice yet, but at this stage is, could we do something about a deferral? I think there's an underlying thought that if we don't, they might have to. But from my listening to the debate there, I don't think it's yet been decided. Obviously, they have to listen to the responses they get to their draft endorsement advice. There are differing opinions I could hear around the table. Nobody's absolutely, I don't think, well, maybe some are, but a lot are not absolutely certain in their minds on what the ideal answer is to this problem. There's a lot of analysis going on with the insurance companies as to the extent of this problem at this stage. And figures are being produced, confidential figures, because they're obviously the company's figures, to try and demonstrate the size of the problem. And those are still being sought and provided at this very moment. I think EFRAG will have another debate on this on the 24th of June. The board of EFRAG will discuss it, both privately and publicly, I think. And so in my personal opinion, we've got to be fairly active in addressing this and discussing it. There are a number of potential solutions to be looked at. I think some will rule out quite quickly, others will take quite a lot more debate. And I mean, they include deferring the application, they include perhaps amending the existing IFRS 4, they include other. There's various options that could be pursued. And I think our board needs to be discussing these and trying to come to some sort of conclusion as quickly as possible. As far as Europe is concerned, the exposure period for the draft endorsement advice finishes on 30th of June, so I assume that EFRAG will get quite a few letters on this matter. They'll have to analyse them and discuss them. And so I guess have a good look at what we're doing to see if that helps, and then make their final endorsement decision probably in September or sometime like that. But I'm not in control of that process, so that's up to them. Do you think September, Dave? September at the earliest. That's probably a fair comment.
Ian, just to Gavin, I think, wants to...
Yeah, just I guess to state the obvious, Ian, but obviously this also impacts entities other than insurance companies. So, for example, many of the banks who I represent have significant insurance operations, and it's clearly important that the board consider, and we may not necessarily have the same view as some of our insurance colleagues, but clearly that needs to be an input as the board goes through it.
And we understand that problem. I mean, what Gavin's referring to is a fine institution like the HSBC has an insurance operation. So if we defer IFRS 9 for insurance operations, does that mean some of their balance sheets under IFRS 9 and some's under IAS 39? And how do people work that out? And how do they pull together a consolidated set of financial statements? Some are suggesting they could do it through segmental reporting, but that's another debate and we'll take advice from people that are involved. So scoping it, if we do give a deferral, even just scoping the deferral is quite a difficult task. It's not straightforward. You know, the insurance project is on insurance contracts, not on insurance companies. So that gives us other difficulties in ploughing our way through this as well. I'd be happy to take questions on this before I move on, if anybody would like, with statements, if anybody would like to make comments or questions.
Does anybody else have any comments, or Anne?
Just a question, Ian. Were these issues that were predicted in the course of your discussions in IFRS 9? And I'm thinking about the other countries which have major insurers which you haven't mentioned, like Switzerland, Italy and Germany. You know, what are the issues, and were they predicted as being of this magnitude? Just to get a feel for the rationale behind a deferral.
Sure. Yes, this was an issue we had discussed when we put out our exposure draft originally. And there's a number of issues. One is the potential for accounting mismatches that could arise in the intervening period and then change afterwards. The other issue is the sheer logistics of doing one major implementation and doing another implementation. In the lead-up to the exposure draft, the board had discussed this and provided some transition relief for insurers that were moving over to the to IFRS 9 and then later the insurance contract standard, because I think it was apparent even at that point that the dates might not align. In the feedback to the exposure draft, there was a request for further transition relief, which is what the board has already decided to do. And this is, I think, a continuation of that debate with an intensification of some of the points of view.
I mean, we had fond hopes that the two standards could come out together and that would have solved the problem, but it hasn't happened. And, of course, there's a strong market and regulator push to get IFRS 9 implemented, because people particularly want the impairment provisions of that standard.
Lothar?
Not always.
Sorry, yeah. It wasn't.
Hi, I do represent the hub group, and we did send a letter in this morning just under the wire. I would add that there's a couple other points to this. One is that the downstream impacts are not just to the accounting mismatch and the cost of that double implementation. And sometimes the double implementation for Canada, for example, could have included something like putting the impairments in for a couple of years and then taking them out. But in some of the countries, especially those that aren't fair value today and would move more assets to fair value, even if it is through OCI, it has a knock-on impact on regulatory and tax. And those would be short-term transition issues as well. So talking to the regulators and talking to the tax authorities about those differences, and then again in a couple of years going back to them for another relief, just seems like not an effective use of time. So those are the real issues, I think, from all of the jurisdictions.
The other issue that was raised, I mean, both of those were raised, was also confusing investors by accounting this way for a while and then changing once and then changing twice, basically.
Ian, I mean, you know, this obviously is a bit of a quagmire for the ISB, if that's a label I can use. I mean, I guess I'd be interested in, from the board's perspective, you know, what are the priorities that you're going to, as you try and work this through, and where, from a standard-setting viewpoint, you're going to end up? There clearly are a lot of competing interests, et cetera. How, I mean, you know, what's the sort of thought process that, as a board, you're going to try and go through to come to the end of this?
I think we'll be looking at what are the issues, what are people requesting and why, how those issues could be addressed, and there's probably 10 different answers. I'm picking a figure, but there's a lot of ways you could approach this problem, or not approach it at all is another alternative. And then analysing those alternatives to find how difficult they are to implement and how effective they would be in resolving the problem. And I don't think there's any simpler way of doing it than working through it like that.
And what's the sort of time frame?
Well, that's another problem we have. I mean, I said that perhaps EFRAG would come to a recommendation by September. It might be a little later than September. But if we've not thought through the issues and come to some conclusions, we have to have done that, I think, before they come to there. And they're looking to us. I mean, to be fair, to give them some guidance on how they might tackle this. Their first preference is for us to solve it. But they can't wait around forever. So, you know, I would have thought we've got August with no board meeting. We've got June and July. And then we're into September. So time frame's quite short.
I think part of the issue is that whatever we do, if it can't already be solved within the existing framework of IFRS 4 and the existing IFRS 9, then we will need to do some sort of due process. So that implies a certain amount of time as we get exposure draft out and comment letters. And even in the shortest case, that doesn't give us an awful lot of time. So I think that thought needs to be factored in. How much do we need to do? How far down the line do we need to get in order for EFRAG to be comfortable that we're serious about doing something? I think we don't expect that whatever we do is going to be pretty. I think we're looking at a fairly broad brush stroke that would address a problem on the assumption and the understanding that it is for a limited amount of time. And I think that in itself creates some problems because the insurance contracts project has been 18 years and still young, as Zane says. And so the belief that we need to be actually talking about a limited amount of time needs to be assessed as well.
I guess from the comments here and around that, I mean, understand the difficulty that facing, but certainly from the comments that Gavin is think about what the priorities are and obviously be transparent as much as you can and about what is happening and how and why.
I think that's totally correct, yes.
Keep going then, Ian.
Okay. While I'm ahead, do you think?
Yeah.
Could debate that. Conceptual framework. We think we've got a rather more success there. We've got the exposure draft out. Our original program for this project was to finish September this year. We clearly won't do that because we won't have comments back from our exposure draft until the end of November or thereabouts. We'll be considering those over December, January, February, I would think, and hopefully we can get something finalised next year. And I think if we can do that, I think we've got... you had an education session on it this morning, or some of you did.
Yes.
I think we've got a reasonably good product. I think the biggest criticism that was made in the discussion paper and will probably be made again with the exposure draft is we haven't gone far enough on some issues, particularly measurement and profit and loss OCI. We see it as a living document. I mean, we don't want to be changing it every day, but I think we'd acknowledge that there is more work to be done in some areas. Equity liabilities is another area, and that we would try and progress with that. Measurement's difficult because it's a bit the meaning of life once you get down to it and your conceptual basis of what you're doing the financial statements for, but it's something that can't be ignored, and we'll continue to work on that after this particular project is finished. Disclosure initiative, we had a good discussion on, I think, yesterday, and I don't need to say much more. Likewise with the research program, we had a good discussion on that. And now I'd like to spend half an hour on a gender consultation, if that's okay. I don't think we need any... we've got a note here in paragraphs 15 through to 19 on our initiative, which I think... Have we discussed this at the Advisory Council before?
Not at the council, but the investor breakfast has discussed it a couple of times, so I think it would be useful, Ian, to cover it and get Advisory Council members' comments.
Okay. Can you take us through this one?
I'll have the first question.
Okay. Barbara's not...
Barbara is not here still, is she? No, she's gone.
There are there some council members who are members of Investor and Financial Reporting Programme who like to speak?
Is there anybody here who's a member of the programme? The investors? Tuck's going to speak. I was going to need Tuck.
Thank you. Actually, what we are doing is we would like to get more input from the investors community. And what we are starting up is we made a program which we called Investors in the Financial Statements. And we have some institutes who can sign up on our program. And then we would like to have a closer communication with those investors groups. And they are listed in our website. And you can see who are on the list. Some of them are highly profiled financial institutions and also some of the investor groups. And what we would like to do is not only just to communicate with the investors group, rather we would like to make it contribute to the improvement of financial statements. The reason why we are doing is whenever we make an improvement of financial statements, and what we are doing is investor needs these kind of information. However, when it comes to some of the investor group, some of the investors group would say we don't really use it, then what is the purpose for us to in doing that? So therefore, we need a closer contact with the investor group, updating information, what is the current needs for the investors group. Monitoring those current needs is really important for us for the improvement of financial statement. That is why we are doing. And this morning, we have a good discussion with the investors group and discussing all about conceptual framework and leasing everything. So we would like to continue this program.
And just to say, I attended the investor breakfast this morning, and I think it was a very good discussion there. And I think some of the things coming through is obviously the engagement is really, you know, an advice given back to the team there, or given to the team to think about. But thinking quite clearly, I think, came through from the council, if you like, beyond the financial statements in terms of the engagement with the investor community. It's actually thinking about reporting as a whole and how the financial statements fit into that, because that's probably the best way to engage, and actually thinking about even when we do technical presentations to the investor community, it's actually to think more about how it impacts them as opposed to very specifically just the financial statements. So I think that's some of the thrust of what came through this morning, and thinking about the broader aspect of that engagement rather than just that focus. I don't know if anyone else who was at the breakfast wants to make any comment. Or any other members of the council as a whole? Oh, sorry, Anne, missed you.
I apologise. I am an investor representative and I was very busy sitting in the London traffic, so I didn't get to the investor meeting.
I did wonder.
Yes, apologies to that. But what I would like to say is that the investors are very much moving, much more emphasis is on the corporate reporting, not just financial statements. They're the past, they're the history, and we're looking for the future. We're looking at forward on risk, and we're looking at carbon pricing. We're looking at all those issues that either are specific to separate sectors or industries. And so when you talk about talking to investors, I think perhaps it would be very helpful if you put some investor research, so not just with those you talk to and contribute to, but rather put it on your research program. What do investors want? And get to the heart of it through that, perhaps.
Thanks, Anne. And those comments that you've just made were very consistent with the theme of the breakfast this morning. So that's good. Gavin?
And I think this is something that council members beyond those who obviously are investors can get involved with. Yes. So, for example, I had the ISB team in at HSBC about a month or so ago to meet with my investor relations team to talk about the programme that's in place, and also to help the ISB team plug in to a number of the key investors we have in our bank. So I think, you know, there are some steps that as council members we can take to help the ISB move this initiative along.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We've got use of IFRS globally. We continue to monitor that. We've got 116 of the 140 we say are using it. One interesting thing coming out of this for me, we had the Emerging Economies Group this morning, but we had the meeting of the group 2 weeks ago in Mexico, that, and we use the G20 definition, and we've added Malaysia onto the G20 members who are emerging economies, that's how we get to the group. But they are becoming, all those participants are becoming much more knowledgeable, much more mature, and getting into quite deep thinking on IFRS. So apart from our usual suspects, the sort of people we have on ASAF, for instance, the major countries, many other countries are becoming very knowledgeable and mature as regards IFRS and are becoming more and more important contributors to the whole debate. And we're going to have to think how to manage that expansion of knowledge and maturity as we go ahead, because, you know, on ASAF we've got 12 countries, but there's probably another 30 countries that could line up and usefully also contribute at that sort of level. So we're going to have to continuously think about how we keep everybody involved. It's a challenge, but it's a good challenge to have because these people are doing very well. So consistency, I think Yael talked about that in terms of the strategic initiative yesterday, and it's obviously a very strong push for us, and it has been for some time, but again, it's going to be re-looked at. A couple of things that are going on. The Joint Transition Resource Group for Revenue Recognition, myself and Jim Croker, the Vice Chair of FASB, chair that group jointly. It's about 60 people around the table. We do it by video. We have a group in London and we have a group in Connecticut, and we do the discussion that way. We've had 60 odd issues brought to the group. We've had four meetings so far. Just seems like three. You know, I mean, we have another one scheduled for July. From that, three lots of clarification, I think we'd call them, have emerged that we're going to put together in one package this month, and we'll discuss it at the board meeting this month and get a document out. And we've also had another document out on a one-year deferral. So I think that group's been successful. The discussions, in the vast majority of cases, the discussions have solved the problem or at least given people a way forward. Three, we think we need to change some drafting. The question is how long it continues to exist, because people are going to have to start implementing this standard soon. And it's very hard for them to implement a moving target if we're going to be continually changing it. So we're in discussion with FASB and with our constituents as to how we should take this forward. We have another meeting scheduled for November. We're trying to encourage people to put their issues in as soon as possible, because clearly we'd rather have a cut-off. We had some constituents the other day saying, oh, well, it should run on for a bit longer. And I said, well, how much longer? And somebody said, well, the end of 2016. Well, you know, I think at the end of 2016, we're going to have the same problem as we've got now. That, and we've dealt with these problems and other standards in other ways. So let's wait and see. This is all in the melting pot at the moment. We also have a transition resource group for impairment under IFRS 9. That is not a joint one. That's chaired by Sue Lloyd. And it's an ISB-only group because FASB have a different standard in that regard. And they had 8 implementation issues, it says here, in their April meeting. I don't think any of them require any changes to the standard, but they have found it useful to have the group and to talk the issues through. We don't see this as a precedent going forward. We talked to FASB about the leasing standard and whether we need a TRG. At this very moment, I think we're both in agreement that we will not have a transition resource group for leasing. But, you know, these things, as they move along, we'll see what happens. So any questions on that sort of topic?
It appear not.
Okay. Education, we've got a page and a half, and you can see that there's a lot going on from a very small team of people. As Yael again mentioned yesterday, we'll be looking at how we can use the education initiative more for consistent application, so that education on new standards and on problems. It's a difficult line to walk because you're not allowed to interpret unofficially, so our education people can't just go out and give everybody all the solutions to all the problems, because we come back then to a rules-based set of standards. On the other hand, educating them in the principles and the objectives and that level, I think, is very useful. And they've been quite successful in their concept-based teaching, which they've aimed at academics, actually, to train academics in concept-based teaching rather than rules-based or framework-based teaching, I think they call it. So I don't know if you've got any questions on the education initiative.
Maybe just because we did consider and provided some feedback from the last meeting, are there any comments from anybody around any of that and what's been happening over the last 4 months or so?
No. Oh, okay. Well, in that case, I think that finishes my presentation.
Okay, and Hugh, you're going to just take us through some of the technical side?
Yes, well, we have Paper 7A is a comprehensive technical update, if you like. Obviously, you just heard from Ian on the major projects, and we had a good session yesterday on research, which was led by Alan. So I'm just going to pick out the handful of topics which have not been covered through those sessions. The first point to mention, the board issued the 2015 amendments to the IFRS for SMEs in May. That's following the first comprehensive review of IFRS for SMEs. The two most significant amendments were permitting the use of a revaluation model for property, plant and equipment, and aligning the main recognition and measurement requirements for income tax with IFRS. There were a number of other amendments, but they really in the nature of clarifying existing requirements or adding supporting guidance rather than fundamentally changing the underlying requirements in the IFRS for SMEs. These amendments are effective for annual periods beginning on or after 1 January 2017, but earlier application is permitted. So that's one topic, and it's obviously there are millions and millions of companies around the world using IFRS for SMEs, so it's taken very, very seriously. We discussed the disclosure initiative and these other major projects. I just wanted to say a few words about macro hedging, or to give it its full title, Accounting for Dynamic Risk Management, a Portfolio Revaluation Approach to Macro Hedging. That paper was published in April of last year. Quite a lot of feedback received on that discussion paper, and I think it's fair to say it was mixed feedback. The board has started to analyse and think about what all of that feedback really means. And I think at one of the recent board meetings, the board decided it would first consider how the information needs of users should be considered in thinking about dynamic risk management, and how those needs can be met through disclosure. And once having gone through that thought process, then think about recognition and measurement. I would stress, however, it doesn't mean that we're going to be publishing proposals on disclosure and then at a later date publishing a paper on recognition and measurement. It's more of the process by which the board is going to go through this project. And the other point is that this project is going to remain focused on interest rate risk management. I think the discussion paper is couched in terms of any type of risk, but at the moment the focus is going to be on interest rate risk. So that's macro hedging. I won't touch on research, as we heard yesterday from Alan, there's a lot of projects on that agenda. So perhaps, and just to briefly mention, I think we touched on this yesterday, actually, that we have completed a post-implementation review of IFRS 3, which resulted in two new projects going onto the research agenda, so the definition of a business and goodwill, thinking about the financial reporting requirements for goodwill, both on initial recognition and subsequently. Let me say then a few words about the IFRS taxonomy. So there are two trials which are ongoing currently. The first one is really to assess the idea of publishing a taxonomy update at the same time as we issue new or amended standards. And the amendments to IS 7 fell into that category. The comment period for IS 7 finished in April. And initial indications, and looking at some of the feedback, the initial indications are that there's little support for the proposal to publish an IFRS taxonomy update at the same time as an exposure draft is issued. So that's quite interesting. The second trial relates to the review by the ISB of proposed taxonomy changes as regards common practice additions. And here, rather than subject such additions to full board approval, what has been decided is to set up a panel consisting of three designated members of the board who will review proposed common practice taxonomy elements as that subgroup, and that's felt to be the most effective way of taking that trial forward. I think other than that, just to mention in terms of what is going on at the Interpretations Committee, you have towards the end of the paper mention of the draft IFRIC interpretation uncertainties in income taxes. So the committee has tentatively decided to publish a draft interpretation on that subject, and it will aim to address diversity in practice for recognition and measurement of a tax liability or asset when there is uncertainty in the application of tax law. At the back of the paper, you have a summary of all the different implementation projects which are ongoing. And you also have, as an appendix, the current IASB work plan, both as regards major projects, the implementation projects, as I mentioned, and the research projects, which we touched on yesterday. So that's kind of the residual of topics, which I think we didn't cover, and that's probably all I wanted to say.
Just add, as well as all these schedules, Hugh and his team maintain a monthly good look at all the projects, including all the resource implications of all the projects going forward, and that's been a very useful addition to our monthly reporting. I don't know that the council wants to see it because it's quite detailed, but just to be aware that we are looking at the implications of all these.
So just from a council perspective and thinking about our role rather than asking or commenting specifically on technical matters, are there any areas, if you like, of further explanation that would be useful for us as advisory members and or advice around any of these topics at more of a strategic rather than a technical level from what we're seeing out in the world that we would like to pass back to help the team? Gavin.
So I'm going to couch the question in the context of one of the projects, but I think it has broader implications as we've talked about as a council. So when I look at the macro hedging project and you say, you know, as a first step, you're going to look at the information needs of investors, it won't necessarily become a disclosure project, but that's where you're starting. So I guess my question is, what's the thinking of the board in terms of how narrow that look is going to be? And the reason I ask it is because I think, you know, hedge accounting is a subset of all economic hedging activities that go on. And indeed, to some extent, it might not necessarily actually directly reflect the economic hedging that goes on. Feedback I've heard over a period of time from investors is, you know, actually with that sort of fairly narrow focus, they don't find the accounting disclosures at all insightful or helpful, by and large, probably a broad generalisation, but that's generally what I hear. So when we, for example, as a council, talk about, you know, what involvement does ASB need to have from a broader reporting perspective, I guess to bring the question back, when the board thinks about the macro hedging project, is the board going to take, therefore, a broader interest rate risk management perspective on the information needs of investors or not? And if you do, how do you then see that feeding back into what will, by definition, be a much narrower accounting project?
Well, the answer has to be that the board will take a broad view on this. I think it's hedge accounting is a tough topic, isn't it? At the moment, I guess we still, with IAS 39, we have a very rules-based approach to what is going on, and investors, I suppose, struggle to understand how the current requirements enable preparers to effectively report the economics of what is going on. And I think these broad questions of what the board is definitely interested in and is the approach they want. I think how it all feeds back into the project is the board is going to be very careful how we do this. And I think, you know, one of the things, for example, that the board has discussed is the need to set up an expert group. I don't think that's going to be done anytime soon. But I think that will be an important component of informing what actually eventually comes out in respect to this project. I think at the moment the board is interested to develop the thinking much more before we set up this expert group, but I think it will at some point is a step that will be taken in order that we've got good process for making sure that we get to a good answer.
And I guess just following on that from Gavin's comment in terms of that expert group, just to ensure that it is considering the broader aspects as opposed to just the narrow technical expertise in terms of your expert group, I think is the thrust of where Gavin is coming from. Jake?
Thank you. I guess I had a couple of questions. The first one would be, the board's obviously done some great work on some very large projects, revenue, financial instruments, etc. But the path of the standard setting of those has not been necessarily entirely linear, and I was wondering whether there were any lessons that could be learned from that process that might make standard setting smoother in the future. And my second question is really about what does standard setting of the future look like? Typically, my impression is that standard setting tends to be a reaction to things that have happened in the past, so IFRS 9 being a reaction to the financial crisis. And I wonder how much time the board or people at the ISB actually give to thinking about what problems might there be brewing out there and what should our reaction be proactively rather than reactively.
And Jake, I guess that question as much as anything else comes in terms of the consultation document that's going out.
Well, will it be smoother going forward? That was your first question, I think. You know, we've had continual extension of our due process. And this is good. This means we consult more, we listen more, people get a chance to react more. But it brings with it problems. And, you know, sometimes in some standards, people are opposed to the idea from the start. Putting your leases on the balance sheet's a silly idea. They're not on the balance sheet now. Why would you want to do it in the future? And if you have that opinion at the beginning, and you stick by it, then every step of the due process, you'll make that point again and again and again, but in different ways, probably each time. So the length, and, you know, we've had two exposure drafts for all those projects. Now people want us to put our fatal flaw review out for public comment, which would effectively be another exposure draft and another year or two to the process. So I don't see us cutting back on due process going forward? Well, I'd quite like to, but I don't think I could convince my trustees that it's a good idea. And so it's going to be bumpy unless we've got something that everybody agrees on at the beginning, which I've never seen happen before. Then it's going to be bumpy, and there's going to be debates, and there's going to be disagreements, and there's going to be people that are unhappy, and at the end of the day, the board has to make a judgment, having listened to all that, on what's the right thing to do. Yeah, sure.
I guess when I was thinking of that, I was thinking more about IFRS 9. Originally, there seemed to be a firm decision that we would have two categories, a financial asset, and there seemed to be various different bits of feedback post those decisions being made. So I guess I was more commenting from the point of view that it seemed like the board had made up its mind, but then further outreach gave rise to different models.
And that's what our process is, listening to people, and if they've got a good point, going along with it. And that gives us our legitimacy at the end of the day, transparency and a adequate, proper due process. So I don't see it getting shorter or easier as we go forward. I mean, if you take macro hedging, which Hugh's just talked about, it's an enormous topic with a great diversity of views on what should be done. And we just, you can't rush something like that. We've really got to listen to people and really think through the implications of anything we might do. Reactive or proactive? Look, we try to be both. And we are looking at the market and we're listening, and people come to us all the time with problems. The agenda consultation will highlight some more. People last time, and I think this time too, will say, we want a period of calm. Why can't you leave the standards alone for a while? And, you know, I mean, implementation for insurance would be 21 or 22. So we're looking 6 years out there, 5 years out there before that hump gets over. So everything we do creates change, and people don't like change much, and for good reason quite often. That's what the agenda consultation's about, really, that big picture reflective sort of look at what is it we should be doing. Could argue that probably a three-year cycle is a bit short.
In answering your questions as well, Jay, obviously we had a good session on research yesterday from Alan. And the big projects you mentioned all predated that research programme. Obviously the entire point of the research programme is to make sure we've got a good understanding of the problems before we set off on a standard setting path. And the intention is that that will make a more effective and faster process.
Garth?
Yes, my question just relates to the revenue transition resource group. The impression I get is that this group is going to come to an end fairly shortly. I don't know if that is correct or not, because it talks about encouraging constituents to submit any remaining questions as soon as possible. If I'm correct in that assumption, my concern is that for many people, they haven't really applied the new standard, and whether there aren't likely to be far more questions when people actually have to apply it in practice. And the second issue just relates to this group is that I think one of the reasons to have this group both here and in the US was to try and reduce sector groups. And I didn't know whether particularly in the States, and I don't know if Danita wants to comment on that, as to what extent sector groups are being used there to interpret the standard, which could have an impact on how it might be implied that those sector groups should apply it internationally as well.
A couple of questions. There'll be practice questions on revenue for the next 5 years. Now, do we keep the resource transition group open for another 5 years? We've dealt with this in all other standards. This is a new process. In other standards, there's also always questions. They come to the staff generally, the vast majority are dealt with in that way quite easily. People sometimes have to think for themselves and come up with their own solutions instead of coming for answers to everything, which leads to a rules-based business at the end of the day. So it's a tricky question. It was set up, this was a major standard affecting all companies, and it was felt, and a converged standard, so it was felt this was a useful way forward. It hasn't been decided to wind it up. It hasn't been decided to keep it going. We're waiting to see. Let's see how the issues come. Let's see how we deal with our July meeting, which is not far away, and see if other issues come up in November. The point that some people haven't even begun implementing it yet has been brought to our attention as well. But then how long do we wait for them? And as I say, we've got at some point get a stable platform for people to implement from. So it's the usual question of judgment. Now I'll finish, Philippe. And sector groups, it is interesting. We don't see them, I don't think, so much in the rest of the world, but in the US, I think AICPA are quite active in getting sector groups together to discuss this standard. And your point about if they make decisions or have discussions that have a sort of a firm ending, does that affect our gap? Well, this is one of the problems of convergence. If we're going to have converged standards, then either the interpretations or education or whatever from the US has the potential to affect our constituents, not just because US companies will do it internationally, but that people will look to the US interpretations or decisions anyway, if we haven't made them. I don't know how we can deal with that. We're dealing with it by trying to do the same thing at the same time at the moment, which is not all that easy. I mean, even on the three minor amendments we're making, we have far fewer words than the US standard set is going to have. We think they lead to the same conclusion. But, you know, there's always devil in the detail, isn't there? And so keeping converged is a challenge. And IFRS 3, where we're going to be looking at goodwill and impairment and the like, is another challenge. We'll be doing that with the US. But whether we come to the same answer or not is a different question. Sorry, Philippe, you wanted to comment.
I just wanted to add to that although it might be to a lesser extent than in the US, but there is a lot of activity going on in other jurisdictions with preparer groups being organized at the national level and sitting together and discussing implementation. I think it's true in Germany, it's true in France, it's true in Switzerland and many others. And there are on top of that some industry groups also that are very transnational, because if you take the pharma industry, I think they talk a lot about how to deal with licenses. And it is not on a jurisdiction basis, it is worldwide, because those groups try to coordinate on a worldwide basis. So I think it's not a bad thing that people at industry level sit together and try to have a consistent understanding and application of the standard at their industry level. So I think we should accept that as being a normal process.
Yep. Okay, Anne.
This discussion has been very, very helpful. I'm hearing a never-ending set of demands upon the staff's time for increased communication, increased education, increased participation in conferences, all of which is very resource-rich, really. And I have great empathy for the way in which you have been managing. And I see the list there, very, very great involvement in communicating your messages out there. But I would also suggest that perhaps there is some way we can leverage the technology a little bit more. For example, this morning we had an educational session on prudence. If that those sorts of sessions, when you have them really well constructed, are videoed, set up as a webcast or a podcast, it may be a way of maximising resources. I know you already use this technology, but I think try to use it as much as you can strategically in order to stretch your resources for communication, because I have a great sympathy for how much is being demanded on how few. So,
That's a good point, and you're right. We do use it, whether we use it adequately and, you know, whether we can use it in other ways, we need to continue to look at and to act on, that's for sure. I don't know that the demands for us to communicate are increasing. I think they've always been there, but they're large.
But just to mention as well, I mean, we do have a project ongoing, which is a part of the education initiative to look at other ways or more effective ways, if you like, that we can communicate widely. I think we touched on it at one of our earlier meetings. That may or may not include multimedia, but it's something that's being assessed.
Thanks for that feedback, Ian. Danita?
Just to respond, or a little bit more information on what the AICPA is doing, and I think Philippe made some really good points about industry groups all over the world. The AICPA has accounting and audit guides, as you may know, that are industry specific. And so it was, they believed, incumbent upon them to need to update the guidance that was currently in their existing accounting and audit guide, or guides. And so there are 16 different industry groups, and not every one of those had an existing ANA guide, but most of them did. So what they are doing is going through, and they've got a group established for each of those. They're going through, and they are proposing updates to their guide. There is then sitting on top of that kind of an expert panel, I think is what they call it. That revenue expert panel has to approve everything. In a number of cases, or some cases at least, they are identifying issues that they believe need to go to the TRG to be discussed more fully, because they are trying very hard to make sure that they're not taking interpretive positions that would be potentially consequential, potentially contrary to the standard. Places where they think it needs some more discussion, they are going to elevate that. But there's another set of checks and balances before it goes forward, and that is FINRIC, which is the AICPA's body, kind of their top technical body. I actually sit on that. So we have to, first of all, we have to approve all of the changes for every ANA guide, and they're going to be exposed for public comment, and we weigh in on the issues that are going to be brought to the TRG. And those people have heard, or all of those groups have heard loud and clear, the same message that Ian was just articulating about identify your issues that need to be elevated and get them in, get them written up and get them in. So I think maybe it's a little bit more formal than what we see going on in some other countries, but I think it's not inconsistent with what Philippe was talking about. And I know on some of those groups, at least, they are having multinational discussions, because I know people that are sitting on some of those groups and have been involved in some of those discussions where they're talking internationally, which I think is a great thing.
Thanks for that, Danita. And I was thinking before, when the comment was made about the US, that actually this is actually about consistency of application of IFRS, happens to also be FASB, you know, around the world. And that is one of the biggest issues actually facing us, as to how to get that consistency, because every country, as you say, whether it's a new standard or an old standard, will have their discussions. Industry groups will have their discussions. And it's how the hell do we ensure that there is consistent discussions and application at the end of the day? So it's not unique to this particular one. It's a much bigger issue, which obviously we talked about and is in the document for consultation. Goro.
Okay, I'd like to ask Ian about, you know, the ASAF. You told that the you found that emerging market group is increasingly knowledgeable and the mature. And you expect that the more contribution to standard setting. And do you expect that the that will affect that the future representation of ASAF membership, or and how long it will take that the.
I don't really know the answers to those questions, but I'll give the best answer I can. We've just reviewed ASAF. We think that 12 which is what we've got, is a good number, and it's a manageable number around the table, and we have a good two-day meeting, deep technical meeting, and we get very good responses from all the ASAF members. So I think the trustees will discuss this next week. I think there'll be a sort of a three-year term forward on that basis. But this momentum underneath is building all that time. And I would predict that in about 3 years' time, we'll have to be thinking seriously about how we get more contribution from these people. It may be doing it other ways. It may be that we'd leave ASAF the way it is, but have other mechanisms for the Emerging Economy Group is already one, and there could be others. So I don't see a revolution coming, but I see an evolution coming that we're really going to have to think about and be aware of as time goes on.
As you say, Ian, a real positive that around the world there are far more people who are proficient around the standard setting and technical in the area. I mean, it's actually great. A good problem to have. Okay, on that note, are there any more queries, comments, advice that members would like to give or make around this, the ISB activities over the last 4 months and going forward? In which case, draw an end to that part of the session. And move on to our next session.